Accession number 23100-5.
So, you've been given your new posting, you've been given your leave. You caught the train to London after your 3 weeks' leave and turned up at Baker Street?
I arrived in London on the Monday morning, and I went to the hotel I'd used with my father also in business from the 20s, York Hotel, Berners Street. Across the little lane of York Lane, there was the Berners Hotel. The same firm owned both, but Berners was 5-star, York was only 4. My father was cautious. And I turned in there in the early morning and said, "Here I am, Lance Corporal Fife." "Oh, hello, sir. In uniform." "In uniform, yes. And can I stay here for a day or two?" "Yeah, oh, delighted, come in." He would have found me a room whether it had one or not, because he was quite well known. And I was ushered in. I had a quick breakfast, reported in accordance with instructions at 64 Baker Street. Colonel Kennedy, he handed me £42, explained that I was commissioned as a second lieutenant, and could I fit myself out? He said, "You'll get something off the peg. Have you a battle dress?" "You have, obviously, if you're wearing one." "Could you unpick that stripe?" I said, "Sir, I can unpick that stripe. You'll never know there's been a stripe there." I was in the fashion trade, sir. "Oh, you won't need a battle dress then." I said, "No, sir, I don't need a battle dress. I have 2 battle dresses, and I'll unpick my stripes without any bother." "Good. Any change over the 40, just keep." So I went off to Selfridges, and I took an off-the-peg service dress uniform, and I got boots, which I'm still wearing. Got this felt shoe, I'm still sitting there in the bedroom. I had them rebuilt. Other bits and pieces I bought, and later on I also got in touch with Apps, that means nothing to you. Alfred Polikoff and son were big gents manufacturers of suits and coats, and I got Miss Burns down there to make me, she had my measurements, because I got suits from them, she had my measurements, and she made me a beautiful Barathea, fine Barathea, number one service dress, which is in the trunk out there, along with the discarded other Barathea as well. So I turned up in the evening, Tuesday morning I turned up for breakfast as Lance Corporal, came back with this, I bought myself a Revelation suitcase, which now houses the Kirk Trust's medieval manuscripts up there, and came back with this Revelation suitcase and came down to dinner as a second lieutenant. Reported in due time again to Colonel Kennedy, was then taken across to security. I had to report to security, and of course Wetmore was there, and that was that.
Did they tell you anything about what SOE was?
No. I was supposed to know. I'd been at Group A. All I was told was that there were certain country sections. We knew that there were nationals coming up, because we were warned to keep them apart. They mustn't even see each other. And of course the contours up in Group A are such that each house is screened from its neighbour. It can't be seen. And its own particular little estate policies, you could put a battalion in there and they wouldn't be seen from Camastar. I couldn't see Garamore. And that's why it was survival for training purposes, because they could have 5 or 6 different teams working in the mountains there. Day after day after day, they wouldn't see each other. That was the great value of it. And, we picked up as we went along. We had NCOs stationed, after they were settled and established, NCOs from our section were stationed in each of those areas. And they came back with tales about Sykes and Fairbairn, and they discussed with those of us, like myself, who weren't seconded. They told us the kind of training that was going on and the personalities involved, and the Czechs were there, there were Poles, and there were French.
What about Baker Street? Was it a hive of activity?
It was pretty busy. The main officers, that was Sherlock Holmes address, of course, 64, and that was that was busy. But then the other place was Michael House, which was next door across the lane. That was the headquarters of Marks and Spencer's. And the security and the photographic and Archie Boyle, the Admiral was there too. No, Redding wasn't there. Redding was RAF, he wasn't there. But passports were there, photographic, and all the security lot were there too. Then there was Nordsby House across the street, and then latterly there were Montague Mansions as well. And then eventually, of course, we'd Enfy way out in Bryanston Square later on, plus the various country section flats.
Was security tight on Baker Street? I've often asked this question of people, and they've never really given me a satisfactory answer. Did you?
It was quite tight. It was quite tight. It was perhaps a little less tight than ISRB, because that was inter services and all sorts of uniforms walked in and out. But they generally had to ask where they were going. Where did they find so and so and such and such? They had to be guided to where they were going. To that extent, there was security. There was somebody, are you looking at, for the odd bod coming in, who are you? And you didn't reply, who's yourself?
Did you have to show a pass?
Oh, yes. You had to sign a wee chitty at the door. There were some chitties there in that bundle of stuff, which had to be signed and had to be passed in again when you came out. And if you were passing from one house to another, that pass didn't do you from ISRB to Michael House. You had to fill in another pass at Michael House. And same for Nordsby and then Montague Mansions too. Oh no, it was quite tight in that sense. Those of you who were on the staff would float in and out, because the security look at the entrance, or in the wee bully hole, knew who you were and you were allowed in. But any stranger, excuse me sir, whom do you wish to see? And there was that security.
When did they finally tell you what you were going to be doing in SOE?
Well, I had to go to report to security so that they knew this little squeak was on the staff. And then I was taken across to meet the Spanish country section. I knew nothing about them. I had heard the name Sconce, because the Sconces, that was a code name for Spaniards, and they had been on courses up in Group A, and we learned of the Sconces through that association with these little teams who came up to Group A, and we all knew in 49 section the Sconces were Spaniards, and that was the code name for Sconces. But then there was a ban put on the name Sconce, an instruction from government, this name will no longer be used. But I went to the Spanish Company Place office. Captain Alistair Hamilton, very pleasant man he was, 30s maybe, fair haired, very affable chap, and Lieutenant Howard. Sub-Lieutenant Howard, RNVR, and they hadn't got a word of Spanish between them, except what they'd read in Western novels and cowboy books. But they said, you're going down to the Spanish Company section, holding school. There's a confusion about this. That man Cunningham, he wrote a book in Bewley.
Oh, yes.
And he is disastrously scurrilous about the Spaniards. And he claims that Tame Park was always a wireless. It wasn't up until September when I left it in 1941. It was still holding Spaniards, 80 odds of them. But anyhow, these two chatted to me and said I was going down there to take part in the training of Spanish troops who were there. And they gave me a general background. These were men who had been involved in the Spanish Civil War on the communist side. They'd been defeated, of course. And it comes through far more war than I was able to know. They escaped over the border to France. They asked for hospitality, and the French immediately offered it. Yes, of course, come in, but you'll have to put on French Foreign Legion uniform, or else back over the frontier to the Franco police. And most of them, in fact all of them, I think, opted for French Foreign Legion uniform, and They did very well in Africa in their training and other jobs they did. Then when war broke out, they were shunted over to France and they served as a unit and they displayed great courage. And just before the fall of France, a whole group of them, of that particular lot, made their way to Bordeaux, and they were lucky enough to find a British vessel in dock, and they took them aboard and dumped them in Plymouth. And there, because they were neutrals, or at least Spain was supposed to be neutral, they were embodied in the Pioneer Corps, non-combatants. And there they distinguished themselves in the Blitzers. Some got decorations, some got mentions in dispatches. But that was the rough sort of background to what I was going to do. And so I was then under railway warrant to make my way to Thame Park, and they were advised, and I was met by a car, received by Colonel Grayson, Lieutenant Colonel Grayson, Irish Guards, 5-button lot, tall sort of upper crust type, didn't come in the early morning. He and his wife had a cottage in the country outside, and we used to say that when we were out doing PT, he was just reaching for the gin bottle across the bed. But he was a pleasant, very pleasant fellow, and very, very pleasant to me. So it was late afternoon when I got there, eventually, and he took me across, duties were over, to the mess, where there were three other officers there, only the three. Maybe he told them just to be three, he might have put the others away. Anyhow, I was introduced to Captain Blake, M.E.V. Blake, Morris Blake, preferred to be called George, Captain Godfrey Marchant, and Lieutenant Owen Tudor. Blake had been general manager of the Canary Islands waterworks, responsible for all the waterworks in the islands. I never actually understood. Blake had been married, whether he was still married, I don't know. He had a lady friend in the area. But I got on well with George, we became quite close friends. Godfrey Marchant was third generation Anglo-Argentine, and I think his folks were in banking, quite important. He was killed in France. He joined the French section, was killed in France. Lieutenant Owen Tudor, his family were in cattle. And of course my uncle by marriage was involved in cattle in the Pampas. And they asked me, so they asked what I was doing there, and it was Blake who said, "You're a Scot." I said, "Yes." "Where are you from?" And my intelligence bell buzzes, you see, I'm not going to tell you where I come from. So I gave a wide description. I come from Angus, a wide county. "Oh, we'll call you Angus." And that's how I became Angus, Angus Fife. And I'm known as Angus Fife for the rest of the SOE. Only I spelt it in the Gaelic form just to be bloody difficult. And they took me under their wing. I was obviously very, very new, and I became involved in the training of these people, such as it was. It was all military drill, really, because we'd nothing at Thame Park. We'd no assault courses. We did use demolitions to some extent, just to keep their hand in, but we always explained that to the public at large when we were repairing the roads, the estate roads inside the estate. We had a small firing range for handguns, really, but we kept them busy drilling, and we kept them also in fit condition by doing 2 20-mile route marches each week in the countryside. And they were difficult people. Cunningham's book gives a bad account of them, and some of the staff at Bewley, whom he was able to interview, gave him a very bad account as well. But then these girls didn't speak Spanish, and these blokes were rough, and they really were rough, but you could control them, you could control them quite well, and I enjoyed my time with them.
Had they retained their communist beliefs?
We never discussed that. We didn't discuss politics at all with them. They were known locally as Mexicans, not Spaniards. They were allowed to go into town each night after duties. They could go around to pubs, go to the dances. There were dancers, regular dancers in Thame. The problem was that the Ox and Bucks, who were the local regiment, they were quartered nearby, and they came into Thame too, and we problems with that. There were several fights broke out, which we had to kind of quieten down first of all, and then kind of cover up sometimes. But no, they were quite amenable. We had our own practice of going in each night after dinner. We went in ourselves, the four of us, and we paraded the town from pub to pub. We drank half a pint here, half a pint there, and went round the pubs, looked in at the dance hall. I was quite friendly terms with the inspector of police, because I was intelligence officer appointed immediately by Grayson, and I had to work with the police. And I introduced myself to the local inspector and met some of his staff, so we were allowed to penetrate such places as dance halls without paying fees and so on, just to keep an eye on it, to be seen about the place. Now, we had no real trouble, only two occasions, that was all. They were quite good.
Did they wear British Army battle dress? Or
yes, we did. But, and we didn't object to this, we had master tailors in among them, and two or three of these chaps would club together, and one would donate a pair of battle dress trousers. And Pardo was the master craftsman, the tailor, and he would produce gaucho breeks for them with great gussets in the breeks, and they'd wide, almost bell-bottom breeks, which they swaggered into town and danced with in the dance floor. And we didn't object to that. We let them, they reported to the guardhouse, as they were properly dressed, they went in, and they were allowed out, and off they went.
And the cover was that they were Mexicans who had volunteered for service in the British Armed Force?
They were in British battle dress, but they were Mexicans who had volunteered. They had to volunteer from the French. And some of them had a nasty habit of, at a given spot on a wall bordering the lane into Tame, they made a little hideout where they stopped, and they took out a respirator from the respirator haversack, tucked it in this little hidey hole, and instead filled the respirator haversack with lemonade screw tops, filled either with sand or water. And these they used as a kind of bolus in the fights for the ox and bucks. That's why some ox and bucks got broken heads. They could defend themselves in all sorts of ways.
Well, I would imagine some Oxfordshire local lad thinking he's taking on a Mexican and finds that he's against somebody who's fought for two or three years in the Spanish Civil War and then the French Foreign Legion is going to be in for a pretty nasty shock, isn't he?
Yes, they were very friendly, amenable chaps, but don't ruffle them, because they could be very difficult. I mean, one actually drew a knife. He was accosted by three ox and bucks one night. This was a brilliant craftsman, a poster artist in Spain, who, little man he was, and he was beaten up by three of them, and he drew a knife, and he ended up in Swansea jail for the rest of the war. We managed to hush it up as far as the locals were concerned. It wasn't a case in the local court in Oxford, but it was dealt with officially, and smoothed over with the ox and bucks people, and he ended up in Swansea jail until the end of the war. But otherwise, they weren't bad.
And no operational tasks for them during the time when you were looking after them?
No, not at all. I was with them from the beginning of May until September, when I was outposted. And it was still Spanish holding school at that time.
Because there were plans to deploy them if the Germans had invaded.
Oh yes, they were kept fit against that possibility. That's why we had these route marches, and why we kept them constantly drilling. They weren't allowed to laze about, but there's no sort of... We did night exercises, which was simply a question of finding the way back through Oxfordshire countryside and back to Tame Park. And we took them out in the country, far out in a truck, and we split up into groups, and we followed our own little group through the countryside until they got back to Tame.
How did you feel about the comparisons between your work at Tame and your work back in Scotland?
It was a picnic. I mean, it was quite enjoyable. Quite enjoyable. It was a good bunk. I mean, I had a lovely room upstairs. The one thing that was unusual was that Lady Bowden had redesigned the house, and the particular bathroom I had to use was a huge bathroom with an enormous bath with gargoyles for taps, gilt gargoyles for taps. And these gargoyles' jaws were so situated that no matter where you sat, you got a volley down here. It was beautifully timed, no matter what you did, and it had three large double wash basins. And it was panelled in yellow, and the wash basins were covered in half-inch heavy glass, surrounded by glass. And there were glass panels, not mirrors, but glass panels on the walls. And she did a lot of interfering, in a way, with the historic side of the house, insofar that she brought Holzschnitzer from her own native Hungary to make carvings of the panellings here and there, or put new hand-carved panellings in. Beautifully done, beautifully done. But it was desecration in a way, but then conservation was a thing of the future. Not the way back in the 1930s. But it was. I enjoyed my stay there. The food was good. Food was very good. And it was a pleasant mess. We had those three chaps speaking Spanish with me. We had H. Hedgett Goddard, who was the training officer, but he didn't stay long with us. And then he was succeeded by Thornley, a wee chap called Thornley, who ended up at Inverie, actually, little fellow. And then there was Wyon Brooks, John Wyon Brooks, whose father was adjutant of the Wessex Regiment. Little short chap, John Wyon Brooks. He got very pally with a local girl who lived outside Tame, the little village where the Bentley Drivers Club now had its headquarters. But we had a very pleasant stay, and we enjoyed our time there.
So how did the your next move come about then?
From Tame? Well, that came out of the blue. My wife came down to Tame for a week by arrangement with the CEO, because it was a birthday, 18th September. And he was quite agreeable. She should come down. I put her up in the Spread Eagle. Did you ever read that bestseller of the 30s, Diary of an Innkeeper? Oh, it was a great thing. Diary of an Innkeeper. Fothergill. It was the place in East Oxfordshire. The Spread Tame was the place to go. I got her in there. It was the only place. And we were down each night, of course. If I could manage, I went down and had a meal with her first. But in any case, we met up, and she came round the pubs with us. I was one of the party. And then I got a long leave from Friday night until Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock, and we went to town, and I went down to the Spread to stay overnight. We got the train in the morning, went up to town. I had got in touch with an old business friend of mine by telephone, Aubrey Green. They owned Winsmoor in those days, ladies' fashion business, who got us into the Cumberland, because accommodation wasn't easy. I should maybe say, there were wheels within wheels that I didn't know about. Beginning of July, with a buzz, spoke to the CEO, Angus, tomorrow General Lakin's coming here on a visit. I just knew the name. I didn't know who General Layton was, but I knew the name. I've not seen the man before. Now, he's coming here tomorrow, 10:30. I took him a cup of coffee. Report to my office at 11 o'clock. I wanted to show him all around Tame. Show him everything there is to see, and hide nothing from him, because he's security. And then I bring him to my office again at 12:30, and we'll all meet 1:45 in the mess. We'll have a drink together, and we'll all have lunch. And after lunch, you continue your tour. That's kind of floored me, because there wasn't very much time to show. However, I reported in due time at 11:00, and this was a tallish man, slight moustache, slightly half thin, but a red raft of medals here, and they were awards and decorations, not just, including, I found later, this one with a wee rosette here, was the Star of Judah and the Lion of Persia for his Mesopotamian career during 1418. Indian Army he was, and I discovered later, of course, that his brother-in-law was General Sir David Baird, GOC&C India, and his wife was a Baird girl, and they lived in a Minajatwa with her sister, who was a widow. And of the two ladies, the sister was the nicer of the two. Lincoln's wife was an unpleasant woman, but I didn't know that then. Anyhow, this man turned up, and I reported to him, took him all around what there was to see, which wasn't very much. I had to draw things out a bit, and took him back to Grayson's office. It was 12. We all had a quiet, pleasant drink, 12:45. We had a very pleasant lunch. As I say, we had a good mess, And then, about 2:20 or so, well, Angus, continue your tour with General Lincoln. So there was hardly anything left, but I took him across to the little chapel, private chapel, in the grounds. Tame Park was a restoration palace built by Charles for one of his floozies. Oh, a palatial place. Great sweep of double staircase. And a handsome building inside too. And this private chapel. And in the chapel was the embalmed body of a former Countess of Wenham under a glass top. I showed the General that. He wasn't awfully impressed. He may have seen embalmed countesses before, I didn't know. And then I was kind of reduced to taking him round to grounds. We had quite a big duck pond, a small loch in fact, but we had a punt, which I used to punt quite a lot. I would disappear on my own. So I said to General, there's a punt here, General, would you? No, I want a punt. What was that? So I was these lilies are a rather special type of lily. These water lilies, they're a rather special breed. Oh yes, yes. And there's quite a lot of trout in the water here too. Yes, I've seen trout. And then we went to the conservatories, where there was a huge array of peaches, which we used in our mess, because we could buy a box of peaches, 12 peaches in a box for 18 pence, one and sixpence, and I could get a box by the Douch was the gardener's name, Douch would box 12 peaches for me, and for an extra shilling, he would post it off to my wife, and she got a box at least once a month. Half a crown for 12 peaches, when you couldn't get them in the shop for a lot of money in those days. But I showed him these, and we managed to delay things. He was very pleasant. He tried to look interested, and I couldn't understand why I was landed down second. I hadn't even got my second pip. Second lieutenant was a major general for nearly half a day. Couldn't understand the thing at all. And it was only much later that it dawned on me, oh, very much later. Anyhow, there we were up in London, and in the Cumberland Hotel. We did a show on Saturday night. We potted about on Sunday. We knew London too well to bother about changing the guard and that sort of stuff, but we potted about. I think I went out to Ryslip for lunch. There was a good pub there in those days. We came back and we did a show on Sunday night, I think it was The Window, and on, before going to bed I said to my wife, I think I'd like to pay a courtesy call on Colonel Wetmore in the morning, as a matter of courtesy, and he won't have much time for me, if at all. But if I went there at 10 o'clock, he'll have seen his mail, and 5 or 10 minutes will be all I'll get. But we could meet at Waring and Gillows on Baker Street corner, 10:30. All right. So I went into the office, climbed up to the fifth floor, and as soon as I entered the door, I was yelled at. What the hell have you been? I'm looking for you since Friday. Well, I sort of smiled blindly and said, I won't leave till tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock. I'm untouchable. And there was a fury from the other side of the desk. Sit down, don't move. I said, I'm sorry, I'm on leave. You don't sit down, you'll be arrested. Come on.